Kia ora and welcome to the Week in Review. I'm Paul Brennan with a selection of stories and interviews in RNZ News this week. Coming up in this podcast, residents living in a dangerous debris flow zone in the Bay of Plenty beach settlement of Matatā who don't want to move are vowing to fight a council plan to shift them out. Researchers into trans women in sport are suggesting a third category would be one way of removing any questions about unfair advantage. And a Wanaka man has been forced to take down a rental ad for a teeny tiny house after critics slammed him for what they see as the oversized rent he's asking for.
And I would say I'm right on the market, because whenever I have somebody move out and somebody move in, I have quite a few people interested.
Coming up in the Week in Review. But first, what if? A long list of questions starting with those two words have consumed Black Caps fans since the team's quest to lift the Cricket World Cup trophy came up astonishingly short against England in London on Monday morning. The hosts were crowned champions after the final at the famous Lord's Ground concluded in tense and dramatic fashion. The team scored the same total from their full 50 overs and from what were expected to be match-deciding super overs, where each team has six extra balls to score as many runs as possible. In the end, England claimed the trophy because they hit more boundaries than New Zealand. As Clay Wilson reported on Monday's Checkpoint program, it was one of the many talking points from what's being described as one of cricket's greatest ever matches.
Guptill's going to push for two. They've got to go. It's got to throw. It's got to go to the keeper's end. He's got it. England have won the World Cup by the barest of margins. Absolute ecstasy for England. Agony for New Zealand.
A dramatic moment to end a World Cup final, which came to a close with several of them. Black Caps batsman Martin Guptill run out, coming back for a second run, which would have given his team the title. Instead, it was England, not New Zealand, claiming their first World Cup crown, based on a countback of total boundaries, after the two teams both scored 241 from their 50 overs and 15 each in the super overs that followed. Some former international players and prominent names in cricket have heavily criticised using boundaries as the deciding factor. Black Caps captain Kane Williamson conceded it wasn't easy coming to terms with.
While the emotions are raw, it is pretty hard to swallow when two attempts to separate with a winner and a loser still didn't perhaps sort of shine with one side coming through. It just is what it is, really. The rules are there at the start. No one probably thought that would have to result to some of that stuff, but yeah, very tough to swallow.
After coming out on the right side of the countback at the home of cricket, England captain Owen Morgan said the match had to be decided somehow.
If you could give me an alternative, I'd be able to compare the both, but I can't think of an alternative at the moment. The rules were obviously set out a long time ago and we have no control over them.
There was also no control for New Zealand when it came to a moment which helped England snatch victory from the jaws of defeat. After battling their way to what appeared a modest 241 against a power-packed English batting lineup, New Zealand's accurate bowling and fight in the field again came to the fore. And after breaking a 110-run partnership between Ben Stokes and Joss Butler, the Black Caps were on track for the upset, with the home side needing 9 from 3 balls with just 2 wickets in hand. But when Stokes dove to make his ground and his outstretched bat inadvertently deflected the ball to the boundary for 4 bonus runs, England were able to force the final to a super over scenario and ultimately prevail. Williamson, though, wasn't dwelling on that moment alone.
You can't look at that and think that perhaps that decided the match. There were so many other bits and pieces to that game that were so important. When it comes down to a tie, you start looking at every single delivery, don't you? But it was a pretty tough pill to swallow when we're looking pretty likely with Trent bowling really, really well. So one of those things.
Just one ball later, Stokes found fortune again, as Trent Bolt took a catch inches from the boundary, only to step on the rope a split second before being able to throw the ball to Guptill. When the super overs ensued, the equation of 16 to win proved just out of the Black Caps' reach. Coach Gary Stead felt, in the end, that maybe it just wasn't meant to be for his team.
I guess the hard thing is we played 2 games today, we had a super over as well, we didn't lose either of them, we bowled them out as well, and you still don't win the game. And unfortunately that's sport, but maybe it was just England needed it more than us today.
Although ecstatic, Morgan admitted they got the rub of the green when it mattered. The England captain said he did feel some empathy for New Zealand.
The most admirable thing is the way that they play their cricket. They consistently perform and compete against the very best. And they do it in a fashion that you'd have no qualms in turning around to your kid and saying, please idolise these guys, they are admirable.
That kind of sentiment couldn't dull the impact of a devastating outcome for Williamson and his team. But after coming within a few feet of glory, after qualifying for the semi-finals in the fourth and final spot, it didn't mean the Black Caps captain wasn't able to put their campaign in context.
The thing you walk away with is the amount of heart and the amount of fight that the guys have shown throughout this whole campaign, but none more than the match that we've just witnessed, and both sides showed that today, and it did come down to, I don't know how they won it, what was it, boundaries or something, but you know, it was, someone had to walk away with the title and we're gutted that it's not us.
A place in cricketing folklore, albeit on the wrong side.
Clay Wilson with that report from Checkpoint. Residents living in a dangerous debris flow zone in the Bay of Plenty beach settlement of Matata and who don't want to move are vowing to fight a council plan to shift them out. In 2005, part of the town was devastated after a torrential downpour washed logs, boulders and other debris down a flooded river, destroying 27 homes. After 14 years of indecision, the Whakatane District Council, the Bay of Plenty Regional Council and central government are offering to buy the affected properties at a market rate, but for those who refuse to go, the future looks bleak. Our reporter Andrew McRae was outside a private meeting held by the two councils on Tuesday night to let residents know of the plan. He spoke to some of them afterwards.
Rob Pierce bought his house in Matata in 1998. It was damaged in 2005 from flooding, but he was allowed by the local council to rebuild. He has everything invested in this property and he doesn't want to leave it.
Where else are you going to go that's not going to cost $1 million to get live right on the beach, you know, and for everyone to enjoy? I mean, it's, you can't buy any house that's on the beach for $8 to $1 million.
So what do you think you're going to do?
Don't know yet. We need time to go down and process what's happened and take it from there.
Rob Pierce isn't impressed at all with local and central government.
They really need to piss off and leave us alone. I mean, we'll take the risk. I don't know.
It's not exactly clear what will happen to those who refuse the offer to sell up and leave. Residents say they were told at the meeting a land change plan we brought in, and they'll eventually have to go as the area is deemed high risk. Wayne Irwin and his wife Victoria have a mortgage-free property they've lived in for the last 3 years. They spent $150,000 on renovations, which the council had approved.
We've got to make a decision
within a month, whether we take up their offer.
And they said if we don't, we're going to be squatters in our own home.
They'll move towards a land plan change.
So eventually they'd kick you out?
Well, they won't actually chuck us out. We'll be just deprived of our user rights. We'll become squatters in our own home.
Wayne Irwin says the nightmare is likely to just drag on.
We've got a gun to our head, and it's mafia. This is the best offer we can give you. Take the offer or, you know, bad luck.
Marilyn Pierce says fighting any decision to clear the area of housing is a high-risk game for those determined to stay.
We go to court. If we lose, we'll get no money. They'll confiscate our land, and I don't know how they're going to move us off, but if they couldn't, we'd be squatters.
So what are you going to do?
I don't know. I really don't know.
Rick Wally is another one who doesn't want to move. He believes any risk from debris flow can be mitigated by the district and regional councils.
Their process of risk avoidance rather than risk reduction is the wrong way to go, especially when you're dealing with communities and building resilient communities. So, you know, if they worked with us to say, OK, what's the best for you and for us, then we could come to agreements. But at the moment, they're telling us what they're going to do to us and then expecting us to say, oh, thank you very much for doing that for us.
Wade Fleet owns a piece of land in the affected area, but doesn't live on it. He's happy with the decision to pay market value for his property.
Quite clearly, you'll hear there's a lot of emotion that was in the room tonight. Totally understand that. You know, people losing their homes. But certainly for me and my family, we're looking forward to closing it off.
Both the district and regional council were unwilling to go into any detail on the offer. However, the Bay of Plenty Regional Council Chief Executive Fiona McTavish did make a brief statement after the meeting. She says the priority is to work with residents who want to be bought out and have this message for those wanting to stay.
So they need to make choices about whether they opt in or opt out, and they need some time for that. A lot of people got a lot of information tonight and they really have to think about that information and absorb it. The next step, if they do decide to opt out of that, is that there is a plan process coming in the future.
More detail on the offer to residents and what the future might hold for those insisting they aren't going anywhere may be revealed at a media conference this morning in Whakatane.
Andrew McRae with that report, as heard on Wednesday's morning report. Two residents from Matata who will have to make that decision are Wayne Irwin and Rachel Wally. They join Corin Dan on morning report.
Rachel, I'll start with you. I suppose you've had a night to think about things and what was presented to you. Which way do you think you're leaning here? Are you going to stay and fight?
Nothing's changed, really, about what they've presented to us and what we expected to hear. It's the difference now is that they actually have some funding to be able to carry through their plans.
You've been offered a market rate for your property. Is that enough to compensate you?
Not if you don't want to leave. Look, it hasn't been tested whether, you know, what can be done here. You know, the council will keep telling you there's a risk to life and we've done all the scientific reports, but it hasn't been tested. And until it gets before an independent judge, then it's not been fairly tested. It hasn't been put through its paces.
What does it mean when residents are saying that they'll be effectively squatters in their own house if they do decide to stay?
Because the regional council can't explain to us what the end game is. Now, people can't make decisions about whether they should leave or go based on no information. Fiona McTavish said they gave us all the information last night. That's not information to make decisions on. They have been withholding information about the risks here at Matata that the Ombudsman has had since March, and they are not letting it go. They're holding it over for their plan change process. The plan change process and the retreat process are clearly interlinked. They're trying to separate them. It's a process of blackmail. Take this offer we've got for you now. Otherwise, further down the road, there's a plan change in your future.
Rachel, I was just going to say, just Wayne, do you feel the same way, that it is that extreme?
Yes, I agree totally with what Rach has just said. But from my perspective, it's not about the money. It's about I've bought here back in 2009. I wanted to settle back here in New Zealand. It's where I've made my home for my retirement years, and it's not about the money. No amount of money is going to compensate for losing my home.
Do you sympathise though with the council that it's got a public safety consideration it has to make here, and that whilst this sounds like an awful situation for the homeowners, and I think a lot of New Zealanders will sympathise with your situation, but the council too's got a very difficult call here, given that there is a risk of public safety.
Yeah, my occupation for the last 20 odd years has been in health and safety, in which time I worked extensively in Australia. In mining, and I've worked with risk. I think we wake up every morning to risk, to some form of risk. And this was apparently I've done some research into it. It was a 1 in 300 year event. To get a rainfall like that again is anybody's guess. But the thing was, with the last deluge we had back in 2005, apparently it's cleaned out the rivers up above Matata. And from my experience, we should be working on a monitor and manage process. But the council doesn't seem to think this is feasible.
Rachel, just finally, so what happens now? Is it a case of trying to convince everyone to stay, where does the fight go?
Oh, no, some people need to go. I mean, this is a really good outcome. I mean, you heard the guy who had the section holder. They're sitting there. They can't do anything with their land. They've got an opportunity to...
And you're happy with that for those who need to go?
Absolutely. There's people who've been stuck here. And you look at a community who's been stuck in limbo for 15 years. There's a natural attrition there. They're not leaving because they're worried about what may or may not come down the hill in the next 300 to 500 years. People need to get on with their lives. And, I mean, so do we, but we've got to work this through to its conclusion.
Mutamutta residents Wayne Irwin and Rachel Wally on Wednesday's Morning Report. NovoPay is back, haunting teachers and the Education Minister. Teachers' unions are planning legal action against the payroll provider for delaying teachers' pay increases and back pay. That comes after the NZEI and PPTA had been told that NovoPay won't be paying the new rates and back pay for union members, which took effect from July the 1st until September the 11th. The Education Minister has already tried and failed on Wednesday to speed up the process after declaring the delay was just not good enough. Here's political reporter Charlie Drever from Checkpoint.
Education Minister Chris Hipkins tweeted last night that teachers had been asking why it was taking so long to get their pay rises, saying it was the first he'd heard about the delay. One teacher tweeted him saying, "It's never ever taking 2.5 months before. It's usually happening within 4 to 6 weeks, not 11 weeks. Chris Hipkins declared the delay wasn't good enough and he was meeting with the Education Ministry and NovoPay representatives to address the matter. By this afternoon, the minister was back on Twitter with bad news for teachers. He wouldn't front for the media. Instead, his office released a one-paragraph statement.
The Ministry of Education and Education Payroll Limited have canvas options to speed up the process so teachers can get their money sooner. I have, however, been advised that there are no quick solutions, even if we increase resources, due to the complexity of the payroll and the agreements."
But PPTA Vice President Melanie Webber says the reasons for the delay are unacceptable.
"They've been negotiating these collective agreements for over a year. The fact that they're going to have to manage putting a pay increase into the system should not be news to anyone. So to have them suddenly scrambling round and deciding they can't do it is very problematic."
Melanie Webber says teachers were expecting to receive their money earlier and they're facing a financial squeeze as a result.
"There's been a lot of upset from teachers on the Facebook page who had been expecting this to come through sooner and who feel that the government is taking the mickey and taking advantage of teachers.
Both the primary and secondary unions are now speaking to lawyers to see what action they can take against the education payroll. Ms Webber says the PPTA is prepared to keep pushing legal action even after the pay increases are given out in September if need be.
"It's more than possible that the legal action won't be concluded by that time, but what we need to do is send a clear signal to people that this is unacceptable. You cannot wait over 2 months to give people the pay increase that you've promised them."
NZEI National Secretary Paul Goulter says NovoPay has been quick to take money off teachers in the past.
"The strike action deductions happened in the next pay period. The ministry got onto that straight away. So they seem to have found the resources to take money away from people, but they don't seem to have the resources or the interest to give them money to which they're entitled."
Paul Goulter says his union has also been kept in the dark about the delays.
"There was no communications to the union about these delays until right to the last moment. And so it's almost like the Ministry of Education have been sitting on this and trying to hide it."
Hiding it or not, Chris Hipkins says work is underway to replace NovoPay to help avoid a repeat in the future. Small comfort to those who still have another 2 months to wait until getting their backdated pay rises will finally hit their back pocket.
Charlie Drever with that report from Wednesday's Checkpoint program. In a response sent to RNZ, Education Payroll, which is in charge of NovoPay, says there has never been before a payroll adjustment of this complexity. Its chief executive, Arlene White, says because teachers often have multiple roles, there are 139,000 individual jobs requiring pay adjustment. She says the current payroll system doesn't have the facility to easily make the complex adjustments required, so they're having to design, write and extensively test new code. And Ms. White says a replacement payroll service that's being built, called EdPay, will allow much more flexibility and responsiveness in the future. And over 150 teachers are beginning their reo haerenga as part of a $12 million program to increase the use of te reo Māori in the classroom. Te Ahu o Te Reo Māori is a pilot program aimed at increasing teachers' understanding of te reo, and already nearly 700 teachers have signed up. At an orientation day in Otaki, teachers turned up in the middle of the school holidays to do their part in revitalising the language. Mediana Johnson was there.
The kaiako have now become the students. Teachers from Kapiti, Horowhenua and Te Waipounamu kicked off their 17-week reo course today with a pōwhiri. They follow in the footsteps of teachers in Taranaki and the Waikato who are also attending courses as part of the government's goal to integrate te reo Māori into all classrooms by 2025. The Associate Education Minister, Kelvin Davis, wants all New Zealanders to speak te reo.
But we've got to do it in a way that brings people along on board. We've got to normalise it. We've got to be able to hear it in not just in our schools, but in the streets and in homes, in businesses. And that's when we know that we're really moving forward as a nation in terms of taking hold of te reo Māori.
The program is being run by the Kauru Education Group, led by Kai Whakahaere Te Whatanui Winiata, whose whānau have been key to revitalising te reo Māori in the rohe. He says the aim of Kauru is to produce speakers of te reo where the kōrero flows like water.
There is a kōrero that is said, ko te wahapū te tino taumata o te pū kōrero. And so the wahapū or the river mouth is what we aspire to be as a orator or as a person who can command the reo.
For these kaiako, te kōrero Māori like that is still a moemoea, a dream. A Kapiti primary school teacher, Chris Bolton of Te Atiawa, simply wants to kōrero Māori with her teenage daughter, who is conversational in the reo. And as lead teacher for Māori at Kapiti primary school, of which about a third of the students are Māori, Miss Bolton says whānau want more reo for their tamariki.
And lots of their whānau haven't got it. And because lots of our whānau come from generations where, same as mine, where they have not learnt te reo Māori, and lots of them want it back, they want it for their children. So it's really important, as it's important to our school and our school community.
Early childhood teacher Bethany O'Hagan decided that if she didn't step up, no one else would.
I would be using it regularly enough within my daily practice with tamariki and with my other kaiako on the floor that it would make them passionate about wanting to then share that or the children to be sharing with their whānau.
The government is yet to decide whether the program will continue Ā Te Rātou next year, but Kelvin Davis hopes it will keep running long term.
Mariana Johnson with that report from Monday's Checkpoint program. The parents of a severely disabled teenager who say they've been waiting 7 years for a fully accessible Housing New Zealand property believe their son's quality of life is suffering miserably as they continue to wait. The 19-year-old, who we will call Hami to protect his privacy, is unable to speak, is blind, can't toilet himself, and has spastic quadriplegia and curvature of spine and can't walk on his own. He's fed through a stomach tube and needs around-the-clock care. The Mangere State House the family lives in is not fully wheelchair adapted, and they say critical rooms don't fit the hoist provided to lift Hami and can't easily accommodate other equipment to bath and care for him. Advocates for Hami and his family believe Housing New Zealand and the Ministry of Social Development are breaching the teenager's basic human rights by not rehousing him in a more suitable property. Lisa Owen filed this for Checkpoint.
Dad's gentle tickling is Hami's wake-up call. He's rewarded with a giggle and a wide smile. Shower time, though, will not be met with the same enthusiasm because this house is not Hami's friend.
How long have you been waiting for a new house, a house that's better suited to your son's needs?
Supposed to be 7 years.
What do you think of this house? Is it right for your son?
This house is not right. Hard, but we need a good house enough for my son. It's very hard to everything to do inside. It's hard for me, hard for my family, hard for the support workers.
To appreciate just how hard that makes life, you need to get to know Hami a little better. Born at just 25 weeks, he's severely disabled.
So your boy now, can he walk?
No, he can't walk.
Can he see?
Can't see. There's only the hearing, that's the one thing.
So he can recognise your voice?
Yeah.
Can he talk?
They talk, but they know what they talk because they only, that's all they...
Oh!
Hey!
Hami has spastic quadriplegia cerebral palsy, global development delay and severe curvature of the spine. He suffers seizures, his hands and feet are clenched and twisted. He can't toilet or clean himself and he's fed through a tube.
I get up when I hear his voice, but I know he wants to change. Change nappy, change from right to left, but it's so hard. But before I come back to bed to sleep for another hour.
Hami is utterly dependent on his family and caregivers, and they'd like to depend on his wheelchair, the hoist in a house that is supposed to make everyday tasks easier and safer. But they can't, because this house is inhospitable.
How does the wheelchair fit up the hallway?
It's hard, because too small.
Dad demonstrates what is a simple equation. The wheelchair without Hami is 70 centimetres wide with specialised seating that helps cocoon his buckled frame. And this is an old school traditional state house. Think long, slim hallway with rooms off either side. It bears the scars of an ongoing battle with the wheelchair and other equipment, scrapes and bangs. And so does Hami.
We have to wear towel, kick his, stretch his body, otherwise he can kick the wall. That's why it caused the bruise on his toenails and bruise on his leg or something like that.
That's Latu, one of Hami's support workers. She shows me Hami's departing big toenail, the casualty of contact with a hallway that leaves no room for error or unpredictability.
So do you have to lift your son all the time?
Yes. All the time, that's all my job to lift, because I can't use this hoist, can't fit inside the womb.
So your job is to lift your son?
Yes.
And the hoist, it's no good to you?
Hoist is not wet, because can't fit. That's the problem.
Can't fit in the bathroom?
Yes, can't fit in the bathroom.
And not enough room in
not
the bedroom?
Not enough room in the bedroom.
When he says it's his job, it literally is. He was forced to give up paid work after his wife had major back surgery and was no longer able to move Hami. The family gets up to 3 hours a day carer support and survives on a benefit.
My normal job is a carpenter.
Would you like to be able to be a carpenter again?
Always. Always in my heart. That's my favourite job.
How difficult is it for your family, you having to give up your job?
They're difficult because the pay they bring from winds, not enough. Can't pay the bill, can't pay the food. There's a lot of things to do, but not enough. But we do our best to survive.
This is a proud private family, but they've invited us all behind closed doors to see their daily battle with this house. It's shower time. Hami is stripped in his bed and then lifted by two people onto a bed bath. It's a cross between an elevated mesh sun lounger and a hospital gurney. He's covered with a towel as his carers manoeuvre him out of the bedroom and down the narrow hall to a very small bathroom. And it takes some manoeuvring. They juggle the bed, gently tuck his feet in and protect a jutting elbow. And then use an open door opposite the bathroom to get their angles right to get him into the shower. Sound tricky? It is. Here's Latu again.
I believe with this kind of disability kit, that's our loved one. Why take so long for this family to be struggle and upset me? It's true, it's very upset me to see our people struggle. And that's our goal of our country, to take care of the disabled kids, the elderly.
Housing New Zealand says it's converted the bathroom to a wet room, and it has, but it's still tiny. It takes two people to wash Hami in the bath bed. And there's no room for the hoist that's supposed to do the heavy lifting.
The hoist never fit. That's why we have a lift.
Again, Dad's already demonstrated the lack of wiggle room with said hoist. It doesn't clear the shower rail and leaves little space for anything else. So it's parked back in the lounge where it sits idle. The hoist and the house are not friends either. This place is cold too. There's just a small fitted heater in the lounge. I've had my outside coat on the whole time. It's a chilly gauntlet from Harmy's room to the shower, where the door has to be left open because the condensation sets off the house smoke alarms, a sound that panics Harmy.
We hope we can have a house, a place, we have open bathroom for so we can on a heater inside, leave his clothes there, dry there, and for us, safe of a support worker and the parents, to use the hoist to bring in, put in a big bed, to shower, dry himself, do everything before we go back to bedroom.
Once Harmy is dried and dressed again, his carers rub his limbs to warm him up and moisturise his hands and feet. The bath bed that is tinged with mould despite everyone's best efforts goes back outside on the wheelchair ramp. It's a constant revolving door of equipment in, equipment out, equipment back in again. Old sheets cover the floor in Harmy's room so wheels that are grubby from outside don't mess up the carpet. His room is the best one in the house. Social worker Alistair Russell is working with this family.
The potentials for infections from equipment that's left outdoors because of a lack of space, the basic safety issues in terms of lifting a young man of his size, doing that regularly without the equipment. And you can't use the equipment because the house isn't big enough. It's a perpetuating circle of risk which needs to be addressed.
Housing New Zealand says it's widened some doors, but this house is still squeezing Harmy out. His meals are delivered through a tube. But life around the kitchen table is important to this family, and they want Harmy to be a part of that. But at the moment, it's not a good fit.
So sad, because we need the family together. Not the half of the family and one's not there. It's not good for the family to...
Harmy's occupational therapist wrote to Housing New Zealand in May, reminding the ministry that in 2012 this house was identified as no longer meeting Harmy's needs, and Housing New Zealand agreed at that time that the family needed to be rehoused. The same letter says care tasks are being carried out in a totally unacceptable and unsafe manner as a consequence, and the house doesn't fit equipment vital to Harmy's health, therapy, and keeping him out of hospital. It pleads for urgent action. Ministry of Social Development figures show of just over 11,000 people on the waiting or transfer list for state houses, 556 of those households need a modified or accessible house. MSD says it understands this is a difficult situation, and along with Housing New Zealand, it will continue to support the family. Social worker Alistair Russell again.
Housing New Zealand and the Ministry of Social Development, between them, they are either assessing the needs, monitoring, well, waiting lists, and or providing the housing. Between them, they need to get their act together. This is absolutely appalling. It is completely unacceptable. It is not okay. It hasn't been okay since day one, and 7 years later, it is still not okay. When do we as a society accept our responsibilities to actually provide for those people who have the highest levels of need?
Harmy can keep going to his special school until he's 21, but after that he'll be spending a lot more time in this unsympathetic house.
There's no place here, like open place for to look outside to the world and enjoy his life.
The family needs to stay out south for Harmy's hospital care and school. And the battle both with this house and for another kinder one is wearing them down.
My son is on my heart. Day and night. I can't sleep well at night. because of him.
Because you worry?
Worry, yeah. But if they got the good place for him, I think it must be better. But now on, I'm so worried.
So you just need a house that would make that a little bit easier for you?
Yes, yes, please.
Well, we invited both Housing New Zealand and the Ministry of Social Development on the program to discuss the issues raised by that story. MSD declined, saying it's only been managing the social housing waiting list since 2014 and the family's case predates that. Housing New Zealand hasn't responded to our interview request, but both ministries did provide several statements. Now, the Ministry for Social Development says the family's priority for a housing transfer has now been raised from A10 to A18. Now that's just two spots from the very top priority of A20. But this is where things get really interesting. Checkpoint asked for the specific date that MSD bumped this family up the priority list, and the ministry's confirmed it happened 2 days ago. That's the day we started asking questions about this family's case. Now, MSD has now changed its original statement, has come back to us, and it says it actually did another assessment in May that wasn't included in its original timeline, and it moved the family up several steps in the priority list and only then jumped them one spot up following our questions. Housing New Zealand says the family's restricted in where it can live because of the school and health needs of their son. And a lot of consideration, it says, has been given to finding a house that meets their needs into the future. Housing New Zealand says it understands an occupational therapist visited the family yesterday. Not so, says the family. We asked what percentage of Housing New Zealand stock is fully modified and accessible. It did not provide that information. But it says it partners with many organisations to make thousands of modifications to properties.
Lisa Owen with that report from Thursday's Checkpoint programme. You're listening to The Week in Review. Still to come, the meat industry says the actions of vegans who are stickering meat in supermarkets to deter people from buying it are disturbing and illegal. And Baldwin Street in Dunedin has lost its steepest street in the world title.
They've taken something that's ours. We've got to take it back.
Still to come in The Week in Review. Former trade union leader Ken Douglas is welcoming the resumed investigation into the 1984 Wellington Trades Hall bombing. 35 years ago, an explosion in the lobby killed caretaker Ernie Abbott. Mr. Douglas always believed it was a political murder. Police failed to find the bomber, but all these years later, they may now be close. Ken Douglas joined Kim Hill on Morning Report.
Where were you when that bomb went off?
I was at that time the Secretary of the Federation of Labor, and we had a quite intensive meeting with the leadership of the Labor Party about their policy positions at the Federation of Labor's new building in Luke's Lane.
Not far from Vivian Street, right?
Well, that's in, yes, just off Manor Street, actually.
Did you hear the blast?
No. No, we were having a meeting. We got a phone call, I think it was from Pat Kelly, saying that there's an explosion at the Trades Hall, so we immediately adjourned and wandered and raced off up there to see what was going on.
You're in no doubt that it was political, as you say?
Well, my views formed, I suppose, by the politics of the time. We had had really quite intense anti-union activity by the Muldoon government, and that was ongoing to a very large extent. We had had the Tanya Harris marches in Auckland against trade unions, and so there was a lot of emotion. We had had the Hanna-Barbera cartoons of the Dancing Cossacks and all that sort of stuff. So there was a public, I think, reaction.
You were public enemies.
Well, not me, just me.
Not just you.
I never saw myself as a public enemy, but the issue, those emotional outpouring that occurred, I think, was the first wake-up for me, in any case, and a lot of other union people, that terrorism is something that isn't defined by comfortable, old, isolated, geographically New Zealand. And, of course, that's been reminded to us recently by the tragedies in Christchurch.
Yeah. The it was around the same time, of course, as the Rainbow Warrior terrorism incident. You must have had ideas or heard rumours over the years about who was responsible.
Well, about 3 or 4 months after the events, I was given some information about a person that had been repatriated, or sent to New Zealand as a consequence of a safe haven, because that person that had a mental breakdown, he was an intelligence officer working for the MI5 in the IRA, and it had been exposed. And we passed that information on to the police. The information that we were given was that the morning after the bombing, this person was flown out of New Zealand to Perth, where he subsequently was located. We had a name. We gave that name to the police, and they thanked us. And that was all the end of that. We never heard any more of it.
What you've heard... Did you see that cold case episode the other night, by the way, which seemed to indicate that the police were on the verge of this breakthrough and there is a clear suspect?
Well, yes, I saw the programme, and I hope that there is, because I think that it's something of a misnomer for to be determined a cold case. This was the first or the second political murder that occurred in New Zealand's history. after the Waihi strike, we don't have many political leaders knocked off in this country, and whilst Ernie Abbott was an official of the Caretakers and Cleaners Union, his role in the Trades Hall was essentially as an employee, and so I don't think the bomb was planted to kill Ernie Abbott. I think it was the bomb was planted against the trade union movement and I think against the Labor Party, because the media the day before had been full of the fact that this so-called high-powered meeting between the industrial labour and the political labour was taking place that day. So the coincidences of the bomb being planted at 8:30 in the morning, when Trades Hall was expected to be a busy place with this coming and going, what wasn't identified in the Dominion newspaper about that event on that day was that it was at Luke's Lane. They just simply said there'll be a meeting of Trades Hall with the Labor Party. So all those sorts of speculations and assumptions, I think, really require solid evidence, and that's why any information that we gave immediately to the police, and it was left to them. I was surprised that they never followed up. I was surprised that they never ever came back and asked us. I do know that they individually interviewed a whole range of people, including relatives of Federation Labour officials, which was really quite unusual. So,
are you suggesting that the police dropped the ball on this?
No, I wouldn't go that far to say that they'd done it, but I thought that they had a very wide-ranging view, because the thing that was public and made public to us was that there was only two people, this is from the police, there was only two people in New Zealand that had the technical skills to make that mechanism for the timing device. Now, two people in New Zealand, that doesn't take a lot of finding out about if they knew that, who those people were. One was alleged to have been taken out of New Zealand the very next morning. So what about the other person? So
The Mercury switch, is it?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so what about the other person?
I don't know. To be blunt, we didn't believe that it was our right or role to expect the police to tell us what their circumstances of their investigations were. We did become alarmed when we found that all sorts of people were being interviewed, which seemed that a very wide net had been cast.
Former trade union leader Ken Douglas on Thursday's Morning Report. Researchers into trans women in sport are suggesting a third category would be one way of removing any questions about unfair advantage. A new study by University of Otago researchers says transgender athletes can have an advantage because of their higher testosterone levels and physiological differences. But other researchers dispute there's actually no concrete evidence to prove trans athletes have an advantage. Our reporter Katie Todd has more.
In 2018, Kiwi weightlifter Laurel Hubbard brought the debate of transgender athletic rules to the Commonwealth Games stage, and three University of Otago researchers set about reviewing existing literature and studies to determine if trans women can have an unfair advantage in sport. Among them, physiologist Professor Alison Heather, who says high levels of testosterone remain after a person has transitioned. That testosterone level can be lowered to meet the International Olympic Committee guidelines of maximum 10 nanomoles per litre. But she says that level is still too high in comparison to other female competitors.
This is 10 to 20-fold higher than a female athlete whose average is around 0.87 nanomole per litre. So they have that advantage that they have higher testosterone levels, but they also have that former male physiology.
One solution suggested by Professor Heather and her co-researchers is the idea of a handicap applied to trans women competing in sport, taking into account testosterone levels and other physical and social factors. Another is the idea of a third sports category or division for trans women and intersex women. Either way, Alison Heather says it's a conversation worth having.
We just need to have some sensible discussions based on fairness as well as inclusion.
But not all researchers have interpreted the existing studies in the same way or agree that trans women have unfair advantages. Human rights researcher Jack Byrne argues none of the options the researchers have proposed are based on scientific evidence or human rights standards. He says studies about testosterone are red herrings because the majority of trans women reduce their testosterone to very low levels. And even when trans women have higher levels of it, there's not enough clear scientific evidence to prove that affects their sporting ability.
You know, it's serious because it has real impacts on people's health and well-being. And research shows us that trans people are less likely to play sport than others in the general population.
He says discussions around trans women in sports need to be grounded in the positive trans athlete initiatives that are already happening across New Zealand. Nevertheless, the University of Otago research has been welcomed by Olympic Weightlifting New Zealand's High Performance Director, Simon Kent.
The key thing is that the discussion's now being had. More organisations are wanting to understand the topic, and we can get the scientists working together to really fully understand what equates to fairness.
Also supporting further research into ensuring a level playing field is the New Zealand Olympic Committee. But in the meantime, they say they will support all New Zealand team members who are eligible to compete under current international rules.
Katie Todd with that report from Thursday's Morning Report. New study shows suicide rates in the United States went up after a controversial Netflix drama on suicide was aired. A graphic 3-minute suicide scene in the series 13 Reasons Why has now been removed, but many think a lot of damage has already been done. The chief censor, David Shanks, joined Kim Hill in the Wellington Morning Report studio.
Is that indicative, do you think?
I think it shows some very concerning evidence about the potential impacts of this show. I think it's also important to note that there's been at least two major studies that have come out recently looking at this issue, and they highlight some of the problems around really determining a causational result from watching something like a TV show. So we've got numbers out of one study that, as you say, indicate close to 29% increase amongst teen suicides. Very concerning numbers, close to 200 additional deaths over the period. Another study indicates something more like 14%, still nearly 100 deaths over the period that study was concerned with.
This is in the US. In New Zealand, we do not correlate monthly stats, or we don't get them made public. But year by year, we've got 2016, 59 deaths in the 10 to 19-year-old age group. 2017, when the series began airing, 51 deaths. and 2018-61. So we can't read anything into that that would connect it back to 13 reasons why.
Well, the New Zealand statistics, of course, as you know, are incredibly concerning per capita.
We've got
one of the highest suicide rates amongst youth in the OECD. But that we don't have a big population base such as the US to really look at correlative effects. And it can be very misleading just to look at overall numbers across years in terms of tracking back what is the potential impact of this show. I think there's potentially very useful research that could be conducted here, given that we've got a vulnerable population, we know that, given that we know a huge number of New Zealand teens have viewed this show, and the method depicted in this show is actually a very unusual one amongst youth. So there's potentially very powerful research that could be conducted here looking at method or attempts involving the method that was highlighted in this show.
There was another study that was done by Northwestern University in the United States that surveyed more than 5,000 teens just after that first series came out, young adults and parents. They did 1,300 of them in Australia and New Zealand, and they came out with findings like there was an increase in empathetic behaviours and people were more careful about how they treated each other. In other words, the show did what they wanted it to say on the can. It's going to help kids deal with things.
Well, I think this highlights the complexity of human behaviour and human responses to viewing media. Right?
That doesn't make your job any easier, though, does it? I mean, you put an R18 sticker on it, which meant that if you were under 18, you had to have parental or adult guidance. What should you have done that? Should you have done something else? What do you think?
Well, we actually created an RP18 rating for this show for the first time ever, which, as you say, allowed for younger people, younger than 18, to view the show as long as they had the oversight of a parent or guardian or responsible older. And that was because we knew this was a show about 16 and 17-year-olds. We knew it was being marketed very powerfully to a mid-teen audience, and we knew they were going to watch it.
You would also need to do some surveys on how that RP18 rating affected anybody's watching habits, right?
Well, the key thing was it provided a platform to get the message through to parents and guardians that needed to be aware that there was every likelihood that their teen would be interested in or watching the show, and that could have some implications for them.
The question is why it took 2 years to get rid of the scene, given that the mental health organisations, both here and in the United States and in Australia, it all said, this is a dangerous thing.
Well, I think that's highlighted by the research that you referenced before, indicating that, there's some evidence out there that suggests there might have been a net positive effect on empathy and ideation for some viewers. So the evidence was mixed, and professional opinion is also, to an extent, mixed when it comes to made-up media as opposed to real-life reporting on suicides. But I think what we've got here is some very powerful, very concerning evidence emerging out of a major population group, which everyone needs to pay attention to, in particular big platforms like Netflix, who have a responsibility in this space.
Given that they're removing this particularly acute bit, does that mean you'll be reassessing your rating?
No, I don't think that changes the rating at all. The series as a whole contains a large amount of more adult-suitable content. There is depictions of rape, there is drug use, there is extensive bullying. Many things that are relevant actually to teenage lives, unfortunately, and can provide the basis for a conversation with parents and elders. The removal of this particular instructional element of the suicide scene doesn't materially change the impact of the whole show.
Ricky, I mean, how are you doing your job at the moment? You've got this proliferation of channels and programs and delivery systems with an increasingly graphic content. There's another program on HBO at the moment called Euphoria that you've been looking at, I think.
That's right. Euphoria, I think, is a sign of the next generation of this kind of content. And an HBO executive has been quoted as saying, Euphoria will make 13 Reasons Why look like an after-school special. So I don't think you can get a clearer indication of this. This could be like an arms race in terms of more and more intense and graphic content aimed at about teenagers and aimed at teenagers that could be potentially harmful to them. So in answer to your question about how do we do our job, I think a key part of how we do our job is to get this message through to parents in particular about being aware of what your child may well be exposed to or interested in and watching, and getting the right level of kind of warnings and content guidance and ability to develop resilience around watching this sort of material through to young people.
The Chief Censor, David Shanks, on Thursday's Morning Report. The meat industry says the actions of vegans who are stickering meat in supermarkets to deter people from buying it are disturbing and illegal. Supermarkets hit by the protest are having to take food that's been targeted in what are known as sticker protests off the shelf. Beef and Lamb New Zealand says it hopes the practice does not take off. Laura Dooney filed this for Tuesday's Morning Report.
The stickers found on the meat products are anti-meat and are used in a bid to stop people buying the product. A Countdown spokesperson says they are aware of the sticker protest happening in a couple of its stores and that the supermarket does not condone anyone tampering with food. Foodstuffs, which owns the Pack and Save, Foursquare and New World brands, would not comment on the matter. Beef and Lamb New Zealand Chief Executive Rod Slater says people placing the stickers are acting illegally.
Very simply, what they are doing is illegal, and they're interfering with the lives of people that are going about their lawful everyday work and life. It just disturbs me that people like this think that they can come in and disrupt a lawful business in the manner that they do.
Mr. Slater says products that have the label stuck to them are considered contaminated and have to be thrown out. He says the sticker protests have come from overseas and are not widespread in New Zealand.
I certainly wouldn't like to see it gain any momentum. If that does happen, I'm sure the police will get involved, and nobody wants to see that.
Rod Slater says at this stage there's no risk of financial losses to meat farmers as the activity is happening on a very small scale. One of the activists, Dino Stock, says people across New Zealand are putting the anti-meat stickers on power poles, at pedestrian crossings, and on the packages of meat in supermarkets.
Personally, I've done probably about 7 or 8. Other people have probably done similar to that. Some of them were in groups, some of them were on their own.
New Zealand Vegan Society spokesperson Claire Inslee says the organisation sympathises with the activists but is not involved in the protests.
We wouldn't suggest that our members do it themselves, but certainly we see it more as activism and spreading awareness rather than attempting to cause harm or being vandalistic.
She says there are fears within the vegan community such activism could cause more harm than good.
But also, you know, there's a lot of people very passionate out there who think that this is a great way to provide awareness and information to people. A lot of people go into the supermarket and they buy their meat in their plastic package and they're not thinking about the fact that this was actually an animal.
Ms. Inslee says she is seeing an increase in vegan activism in New Zealand. And SAFE's animal ambassador Hans Creek agrees.
I've been involved in working for animals in New Zealand for over 35 years, and we're seeing a huge increase over the last 5 years or so. A lot of young people coming through that really want to take action for animals. A lot of people that decide not to eat animals anymore become either vegetarian or vegan.
But he says the sticker protests are small scale and are just one part of the movement.
They are really designed to get people thinking and start talking about the journey of the animal from being a live animal to being an animal in a meat packet and what happens to the animal and what that means for the animal.
Mr. Creek says SAFE also has sympathy for the activists but wouldn't be involved in that sort of action. A Countdown spokesperson says it offers vegan and vegetarian options in its supermarkets and works closely with local farmers to provide quality meat. They say good animal welfare is at the heart of those partnerships.
Laura Dooney with that report from Morning Report. National's climate change spokesperson Todd Muller has taken a swipe at Te Papa, saying its new multi-million dollar exhibition is biased and not science-based. The exhibition says less dairying is one way New Zealand can reduce its carbon footprint. Mr. Muller calls that a kick in the guts for dairy farming families and says the climate debate is losing all perspective. He joined Corin Dan on Tuesday's Morning Report.
Why do you say it's not based in science?
Well, everyone can understand that our emissions over time have to reduce, including our agricultural emissions. And one would hope that technologies appearing in the medium term can assist that, like clover ryegrass and other things you can give to the animals themselves to reduce their belching. But this particular exhibition has an interactive where it shows the agricultural sector in action, a whole lot of cows, and as the one of the solutions for us to become carbon neutral, you interact with it, and a big sign comes up and said, less dairy, and you know, a huge number of cows disappear from the...
Sure, but how's that not based in science? Because I understand science. That you might have concerns that would hurt our economy and it might be economic sabotage in your view, but nonetheless, it is a fact that one way to reduce our carbon emissions is to reduce dairying.
Reduce the emissions from the cows, Corin, not the cows themselves. And this is...
Well, that is still one way. You could have less cows. I mean, that's...
Well, yes, and all of Asia could have less rice because that's the other big driver of methane emissions.
I'm not saying that that's right or wrong. I'm just saying that it is a reasonable fact, isn't it?
Not in my opinion. I think you can have, from a New Zealand perspective, to have an interactive which sets for New Zealanders as they reflect on the climate change journey that sits in front of us, to put up as the key, one of the key outcomes that should be celebrated in a New Zealand context is less dairy cows, I think is a distortion of the debate.
But that's a legitimate debating point. I mean, I know that you might not agree with it, but that is a legitimate debating point. And to say that it's not based in science, well, that starts to sound a bit like you're trying to have a crack over climate change. It sounds like you're up to something.
No, I'm not up to something. I think they're up to something because there's no... other perspectives put in place at all, because actually the whole point of the climate change conversation is how can we apply technologies when they appear to our sectors which are already the strongest in the world. Our food production system, Corin, is the most emissions efficient in the world. That story never gets told, certainly wasn't told in this interaction. When no one knows in this country that we're leading the world in terms of our emissions efficiency. All they see is this growing view, I think, in New Zealand, that our future is a whole lot less animals that have hitherto been one of our key underpinners of the New Zealand economy. All I'm asking for is balance here. The future isn't less cows per se. It is the application of technology on sectors that we currently do well to make us do better.
That's National's climate change spokesperson Todd Muller on Morning Report. A Dunedin lawyer says some police officers in the city are flouting the law and breath testing people in their homes to catch them out. Marie Taylor Cyphers says in some cases this happens up to 2 hours after they were last seen driving. Timothy Brown filed this for Friday's Morning Report.
The law is clear. A police officer cannot carry out a breath test in someone's home unless they're invited in and the person consents. But Marie Taylor Cyphers says some police officers in Dunedin are taking advantage of people who are unaware of their rights, something she warns is exposing them to a miscarriage of justice.
The breath testing very commonly occurs in private residences, in people's homes, and most commonly in their lounges. This happens all the time. In some cases, there's very clear evidence that the police even reference in their case that they can see that the person's got a glass of whiskey or a gin and tonic in their hand when the police actually enter their home.
Marie Taylor Cyphers says she has recently represented 4 clients in Dunedin who have been caught out like this. Last year, the High Court set aside the conviction of artist Lee Torres Calderon after finding the police illegally entered his bedroom to breath test him in Auckland in 2016. Ms. Taylor Cyphers says such cases are persisting.
Very commonly, there are drivers who are reported by other drivers for swerving or a bit of poor driving. They've phoned in the police on a non-urgent number, and the police have taken around an hour to 90 minutes to locate the person who is now at home and has been drinking for the last hour or so.
One of her Dunedin clients was breath tested after an officer sat in a police car in front of his house for about half an hour and watched him drink on his porch with a builder. The police had received a driving complaint earlier in the day. The man, who didn't want to be named while his case was still before the court, told Morning Report he was just enjoying a couple of drinks on a sunny day, as he often did at the end of a work day.
We sat out there and we were drinking beer. And so there's this police car blocking my driveway, and she's watching us. And she can see we're drinking alcoholic beverages. In plain sight, big deal, you know. It's the end of the day. He doesn't drive. I'm not going to drive anymore. And so I had absolutely no reason for concern.
But after drinking several beers and three gin and tonics, there was a knock at the door and two police officers asked to come in. After questioning him, the officers carried out a breath test showing he was over the limit and charged him.
I find it disappointing that you can be charged without having direct evidence that you committed that crime or any kind of evidence other than the fact that when they knocked on my door, I had on too many gin and tonics. I think that at that point, it's a bit of abuse of power.
Following advice from his first lawyer, he entered a guilty plea, a plea he now regrets, and a year on, he's still fighting to have it changed. The police can't say how many breath tests they've carried out in people's homes in the past 5 years because those figures are not recorded. But Ms. Taylor-Cyphers says even if such records existed, they'd be unlikely to help.
The police routinely on their evidential sheets fill out that these tests have in fact taken place at the roadside. When they have not, they've taken place sometime after in the person's private residence.
One such client is a 19-year-old who officers visited after reports of his involvement in causing willful damage. The teenager concedes he was responsible for the damage, but the police breath tested him and charged him with drink driving almost an hour after he was last in a car, during which time he was drinking whiskey straight and chasing it with RTDs. The officer involved recorded the breath test as being done roadside.
In court, it was found out, and in his paperwork, he'd actually put that the first breath test was taken roadside, so like as if I'd just been taken out of the vehicle or it had been done me getting pulled over.
But under questioning from your lawyer, he admitted that wasn't the case.
Yes, tried to justify it by just saying that's what he's used to putting down. He does it all the time.
Despite this, the teenager was found guilty at a judge-alone trial and will be sentenced at the end of the month. He's been told he has a good case for appeal, but with legal fees stacking up, he just wants to put it behind him.
And they say innocent until proven guilty, but as soon as I walked in there, I felt like I was being looked down upon like I was a drink driver.
In a statement attributed to the Southern District's relieving road policing manager, the police say they are unaware of any deliberate practice of officers entering homes to carry out breath tests on people who are unaware they can tell the officer to leave. And they say officers are committed to preventing and removing intoxicated drivers from New Zealand's roads. Despite the fact police have no right to carry out a breath test in your home without express consent, this is not spelt out in the police policy. Ms. Taylor-Cyphers has this advice when a police officer shows up to discuss driving matters.
Say no and call a lawyer.
She says people need to know their rights and not bow to police pressure.
Timothy Brown with that report from Morning Report. A Wanaka man has been forced to take down a rental ad for a teeny tiny house after critics slammed him for what they see as the oversized rent he's asking for it. But the owner, Thomas Shatovitz, is unapologetic and says people simply don't understand the Wanaka rental market that services a number of workers on temporary visa. And he says if he was a single man, he'd happily live in the 3.5-metre by 2-metre cabin indefinitely. On Checkpoint, Lisa Owen asked him to describe the tiny house in more detail.
It's a tiny house that I built over the course of a year from leftover building materials that I have. And initially I didn't have any idea what I would do with it, and it's come in very handy for me to live in and for renting out. It's more like a bespoke cabin with recycled reamer trims. It looks like a ship's berth in an old boat, you know, so it's quite different.
So size-wise and facilities, can you tell me a bit about that?
Okay, it isn't big. It is on a trailer carriage, and inside it's 3.5 metres long and 2 metres wide, and it's 2.8 metres high. And initially I wasn't going to buy that trailer. It was an unfinished project because I thought it was too small. And then I saw a YouTube video of a guy who had the same footprint, and he got in his tiny house everything I wanted in mine. And then I got it and got working on it, and it works. It's got bedding for three, it's got gas kitchen, running hot and cold water, it's got a separate compartment for a shower and a toilet, but I'm not using that at the moment because it's more comfortable to go into the house for that. That's used as a wardrobe right now.
Okay, so any tenant has to use the bathroom in the main house, is that right?
They could choose to go and stay in the tiny house, but it's not really that comfortable.
Okay, so what's the rent? What's the going rent for a house that's 3.5 metres long and 2 metres wide?
Well, you get stuck up on the size. It's not the size that matters in this instance. It's the self-contained studio. And obviously, one that's in a house and that is bigger, they go for 300 to 360 in Wanaka. And this one is sort of in between a room in a shared house and a self-contained studio. And I would say I'm right on the market because whenever I have somebody move out and somebody move in, I have quite a few people interested.
So at what price level, what price point for yours?
At the 250. And I prefer to have a single person in there. I put 290 for two people, but I really turn people away because I think it isn't suitable for two. I would do that if I can't find a single person only, and that's not really what I want. I haven't had to do that ever.
I know you think people are hung up on the size, but size does matter when you're living somewhere, and 3.5 metres by 2 metres doesn't even seem like a tiny house. It sounds like a teeny tiny house or a closet or a wardrobe, that kind of size.
Well, I lived in it all autumn, and I'll move back into it after the winter. I mean, I'm renting myself, so it actually helps me to afford the rent for a small two-bedroom house. I've got a son who has to be homeschooled due to behavioural problems, and in winter it's just not really feasible to live in that tiny house, but in summer, spring and autumn it is.
What do you think your core market, or who is the person that you're appealing to here? Who would this home appeal to?
The people who rent this tiny house are actually not affected by that crisis because they have invariably been working holiday visa holders who really love being here, who earn a wage, who can still have a good life, who expect to pay $200 to $250 for their accommodation over the winter.
So, Thomas, do you see this tiny house that you're renting as being perfect for those short-term, relatively short-term rentals of workers coming into the area?
At that size, I would say that's all it's good for, unless, like, as I said, I am happy to live in it myself. It depends on your personal needs. And people who always lived in houses cannot imagine that it's actually cool to live mostly outdoors and only go into the box for sleeping.
That's Wanaka tiny house owner Thomas Shadowitz on Wednesday's Checkpoint program. And finally, in the Week in Review, it's been a tough week for Kiwi icons. The Black Caps and Baldwin Street lost titles that many thought were in the bag, but a handful of Dunedinites aren't giving up the fight on the latter just yet. As our Otago Southland reporter Timothy Brown found out, one way or the other, the record for steepest street is coming home.
Guttall's going to push for two. They've got to go. It's got a throw. It's got to go to the keeper's end.
Rules are funny things, especially when they're used to pick a winner. That's when things really can be decided by the barest of margins.
For the steepest street, they had 10 criteria. The prime one that we had to meet was that it should they should have a steepness over a 10-metre section.
That's Gwyn Headley, a resident of the Welsh town of Harlech, who led the charge to have Fiordith Penlech crown the steepest street in the world. After toppling Baldwin Street from its perch, he told Guinness World Records that he sympathised with Dunedin, but a record is a record. Figures are figures. It's inarguable. Well, enter Dunedin surveyor Toby Stoff, who says figures are as arguable as super overs and overthrows.
They're not comparing apples with apples, you know what I mean. What they have is they've got a reasonably steep street, right, but with some sections that are steeper than others, whereas we've got a steep street which is very steep over its entire width.
Now, speaking of fruit-based analogies, it sounds like sour grapes. But Mr. Stoff believes the measurement of Fiordith Penlech was taken around a curve at the inside of the road, providing a far steeper gradient than the centre line.
So what they've done is they've just cherry-picked a particularly steep section of that street. They haven't measured it on the centre line. And if you're designing a road, like all road design manuals, when you're talking about road gradient, they refer to centre line gradient.
It sounds like a conspiracy theory, But we checked with Guinness World Records and it turns out the measurement was taken from the inside verge of the road, which is permitted within the guidelines, but is a huge disadvantage for straight roads like Baldwin Street. To demonstrate the point, Toby Stoff, who is a licensed surveyor for Clark Fortune MacDonald, took the measurements of a similarly steep and curvy street in Dunedin. The gradient on the inside verge of a curve on Lancefield Street in the suburb of Balaclava across town was 33.2%, very close to Baldwin Street's previously record-holding gradient of 35%. But taken from the centre line, that gradient drops to only 26%, demonstrating his point about the new record holder in Wales. Mr. Stoff doesn't expect Guinness World Records to change their guidelines, so he proposes another solution.
They've taken something that's ours. We've got to take it back. We've got plenty of unformed legal roads that are probably being used as four-wheel drive tracks. All we'd have to do is go and metal it, seal it over a 10-metre stretch, and we'd get the total back.
But Otago University student Ben Russell is proposing an even simpler solution, calling on Dunedinites to show up to Baldwin Street on August the 1st with all the concrete they can find and pour it down from the top of the street to increase the gradient.
I was sick yesterday. I thought it might have been a good way to not only lift my spirits but see what the rest of the city thinks, and it came off pretty well. If you know the Hugh Grant movie, The Englishman Who Went Up a Hill and Came Down a Mountain, where actually in Wales they made a hill into a mountain after discovering that the hill beside their town wasn't the mountain, so they trucked a whole lot of dirt up to the top and sat it down on top until it actually became a mountain. Kind of the inspiration for how it started.
So far, 500 people on social media say they will join him, and almost 2,500 have indicated they're interested. Mr. Russell says if it's unsuccessful, he may take the opposite approach and fly to Wales to flatten their street a bit. He says only imagination and money stands in the way of Baldwin Street's glory. Enterprise Dunedin director John Christie says it's great to see just how much Baldwin Street's record means to Dunedin.
I think there's been a few good suggestions on ways that we might be able to get the title back, but I guess it's all going to come down to how much effort you have to put into getting that title. We're certainly very keen to see what the community would come up with and would certainly encourage it.
So while the title sits with the United Kingdom at the moment, just like our Black Caps, Dunedin's residents won't give it up without a fight until the last.
That report from our Otago Southland reporter Timothy Brown, as heard on Thursday's Checkpoint program. And that ends this edition of The Week in Review. The next program will be available to download next Friday evening, New Zealand time. You can also catch up on the week's sporting highlights in the podcast Extra Time from RNZ Sport. All podcasts at rnz.co.nz. For now, from me, Paul Brennan, kia pai te wiki, have a great week.